Tonight, looks like there are 470 participants with us. Thank you for joining us. It's going to be an important and exciting evening. We're going to get into a lot of information in a short amount of time. First, I would like to introduce Megan Riley, the district's deputy superintendent. Prior to her current stint with LAUSD, she had been the chief business officer at Santa Clara County Office of Education. She'd also been with the district as the chief financial officer. Megan loves to scuba dive. That's where she met her husband. And fun fact, she also went to the same high school as Nancy Pelosi. Megan?
Great. Thanks, Amanda. And thank you all. Thank you, Rachel, for inviting me and the League of Women Voters of Los Angeles. Thank you for this wonderful event, participating and partnering with Los Angeles Unified to get more information out and the efforts to encourage people to vote and voter participation. It's such a worthy cause, and I'm so happy and honored to be here tonight. Election day is November 3rd. It is only 20 days away. I don't know if you can see, but I'm wearing my I voted because I actually already did my vote, doing it and dropping it off at the local ballot spots. They're making it so easy to do vote in so many different ways. Los Angeles Unified has such a long history of encouraging people and voter participation, engagement, and public engagement. We're all about the community that we live in, and basically there's nothing more important that we feel than making sure that our young people are aware of civic involvement and the participation that they have in the right to vote. For each and every election, we want our families to be informed and empowered and to exercise their civic right to vote. So whether it's this election and we're electing the new president, or whether it's an election that has, you know, local measures on it, keeping yourselves informed. I love the fact that there's almost 500 people on this call wanting to get, and hopefully we'll give you great information about some of the different measures and things on the ballot. But I just encourage you and applaud you for being informed and tuning in to us tonight. We are trying to make it as easy as possible for more people to really make sure they engage in participation. 87 of our schools are actually designated as voting places, and voting starts there on Friday, October 30th, through Election Day, November 3rd. Registered voters can visit any one of those 87 schools and basically put their ballots in. This November ballot includes federal as well as state and local contests. I encourage all of you to read each and every one of them. I spent the time sitting on the couch with my husband, reading through each and every one. They're all so very important. No matter how you vote, basically just make sure your vote gets counted. And today you'll hear about four ballot measures, ballot initiatives that could impact public education and our students here in Los Angeles Unified. Proposition 15 is about generating additional revenues to benefit K-12 public education students and local government services. Proposition 16, which is to repeal the ban of affirmative action and authorize the use of race, gender, and ethnicity in college admissions. Proposition 18 you'll hear about, which is to allow US citizens who are 17 years of age the right to vote in a primary or special election, so long as they are 18 at the time of the general election. And then Measure RR is a local school bond to upgrade LA public schools. Remember to look for these ballot initiatives and vote. Again, no matter how you vote, we just wanna make sure that everyone gets counted. As of September 4th in LA County, almost 92% of the eligible voters were registered to vote, which is great news. But of those registered, only approximately 4% are at the ages of 17 to 21. So again, we feel as an education, it's really important for our young people to be involved as well. Voting is one of the most important rights and responsibilities that we have as individuals. It's all about our beliefs, our priorities, our values, and getting our votes counted. Our democracy relies on the participation of all who can vote. However, we've seen in the past where voter turnout in LA County for the March 2020 primary election was only at 38%. That's way too low. So we are applaud you all for basically learning about the ballot measures, hearing, spending your precious time to listen. And I encourage you all watching today to register, to actually vote, and to encourage your friends and families who are eligible voters to also make a plan to vote. Every voice and every vote counts and it matters. And I can't say that from the bottom of my heart to all of you, please be counted in this election. Thank you so very much for allowing me just a few minutes to talk about that. I'm going to leave you in great hands to talk about the upcoming initiatives and measures.
Megan, thank you so very much. We appreciate you taking the time to join us. Next, I'd like to introduce and welcome Rachel Plikas. She is a volunteer with the League of Women Voters Speaker Bureau. She's a former journalist who now works in email security with a particular focus on developing anti-bullying email filtering for schools. Rachel is the daughter of two teachers, has a passionate interest in education and voters' rights. We are very lucky to have her here with us tonight. Rachel? And actually, wait, before I get started, I forgot I should have said this. Everybody, if you've got your sample ballot or your information guide or your vote by mail ballot, pull them out so you can take notes. Rachel has a lot of great information to share. With that, Rachel, turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. It is an exceptional honor to be here with you tonight. I cannot believe the number of people. We're at 572 and climbing, so I'll jump right in. Again, my name is Rachel. I'm here from the League of Women Voters. We're a nonpartisan body that focuses on voter education and voter rights. We're going to go through the ballot measures tonight for the November 3 general election. Okay, so the League has two separate and distinct roles. We have voter services like citizen education, which is what we're doing tonight, and action and advocacy. The League is here today to present pros and cons on the current ballot measures that we'll be voting on the 3rd. We will not be presenting the League's positions on anything. If you are interested in those, you are very welcome to find them at lwvc.org. I'm just going to give you the tools you need to examine the propositions before us, and I will explain the propositions and what the people supporting it and opposing it say, the pros and cons, and perhaps of most interest, where the money is coming from. So what are California state propositions? Well, there are bond measures, legislative propositions, initiatives, and referendums. Propositions are proposed laws presented to the public to vote on. They can make new laws, change existing laws, or change our state constitution. They can be placed on the ballot by people who collect enough voter signatures or by state lawmakers. For a ballot initiative statute, the number of signatures must equal or exceed 5% of votes cast for the governor in the last state gubernatorial election. This is why voting matters, because if we had more people voting, it would require more signatures to be put on the ballot. So here are some things to think about when we're evaluating the measures tonight. Is it too complex for a yes or no answer? Is it a solution to a problem? Is it written well? We've got a couple on here tonight that don't meet that criteria, and that's public opinion, not mine. Does it create new problems, et cetera? These are things to think about. So always follow the money. The FCCP website is financially reporting who supports or opposes an initiative. And you can check Cal Access for the latest fiscal impact statements from the State Legislative Analyst's Office. All right. So perhaps the most important information I'm going to share with you tonight relates to the voter information guide. If everybody has this, please open it up, where you will see arguments, pro and con. These are ads. These are ads, and they don't say that they're ads, but they are ads, and they don't have to be true. They are not factual statements. They are paid for advertisements by the people who have donated money supporting or opposing a measure. The most important thing to look at here is if you go under each measure, you will see something that says an analysis by the analyst's office. That's where you're going to find the real pros and cons, the arguments for and against. And that is an exceptional thing to keep in mind as we go through this tonight. We're going to look at where the money comes from. That has a big impact. So Proposition 15 is the first one that LAUSD has asked me to focus on for you guys tonight. In short, it would change the way and timing of assessing commercial and industrial property values for tax purposes. It would assess property worth $3 million or more every 3 years, instead of waiting for the property to change hands of owners, with exemptions for small businesses that have fewer than 50 employees, public golf courses, churches, and charities. So the background on this goes all the way back to 1978 when Prop 13 was passed. Prop 13 is basically the law that governs property taxes, for lack of more information. So just think of it that way. It says that property will only be reassessed for taxes when it is sold, and it categorizes residential and commercial property as the same under current tax assessment schedules. Now, why does this matter to you guys if this is changed? Because it's created a situation where commercial property is being assessed so infrequently, it's not putting the tax dollars back into the communities to fund education. We need it to support things like your schools. So what this proposition would do is it would split residential from commercial property and create a new way of taxing it. Again, it would be properties worth $3 million or more, and it would be reassessed every 3 years. This would create no change for farms or commercial property assessed up to $3 million. And the economic impact to the state is something that we always want to look at. It would generate billions of dollars in revenue, sending the money directly into the local communities. So 60% of the money raised, which is anticipated to be many billions of dollars, between 6.5 and 11.5 billion, 60% of that money would go to local government services and 40% would go to schools. And that money would be dispersed directly to the local communities by the state so that the communities themselves can decide how best to spend that money for your benefit. Arguments for this proposition are that the funds would go directly to education and state politicians can't take it away. Prop 15 gives local communities desperately needed resources, especially in the age of COVID. We're trying to raise additional money to help keep things safe. And it would keep Prop 13's protection for homeowners, renters, and farms. There are arguments against this. They say it would create the largest tax windfall in California history. It would create a massive increase in annual property taxes that could be passed along to the renters of those commercial properties. And they're saying that it would require huge costs to administer. So here's the money. The supporters have outraised the opponents by about $8 million or so. There's been over almost $42 million raised, including by the California Teachers Association and the SEIU. And the opponents have raised almost $34 million. The bottom line is that this raises more tax revenue, as many companies hold properties for a long time, and sometimes they can obscure the change of ownership through LLCs and S-Corps and some other complicated things that I won't go into unless someone asks that question. But the bottom line is, should the state of California amend the Constitution so that most commercial and industrial property is reassessed on a regular basis every 3 years? And now we'll do a 3-minute Q&A, and the moderator will ask the questions and time us, and then we'll move on to the next proposition.
So if anybody has any questions on Proposition 15 for Rachel, please put them in the Q&A. Now, Rachel, there was a question about which which document you are using for this. Should they be looking at their sample ballot or their official voter information guide? What would you suggest if they're following along?
If they're following along, I would say the voter information guide, but I would go to the actual page instead of the quick reference guide. I would follow along with the actual propositions. The only thing that's going to make it a little tricky is that we have these out of order tonight in order of importance to the school district. So there will be a little shuffling back and forth.
Okay, and I can try and help with that. But essentially, Rachel, for Prop 15, when you were just talking about the arguments in favor and against and pros and cons, that was page 24 and 25 of the official voter guide, correct?
That's an excellent question. it would be. I confess I've torn some pages out of my voter guide.
I will do my best for those who are asking to provide those page numbers. Does anybody have any questions of Rachel on Prop 15 that she can answer?
Yeah, Amanda, there's one that asks, is there anything in the measure that prevents the pass on of cost to consumers?
To consumers? No, I suppose that it could trickle down because the property owners, their taxes will go up. In many cases, these commercial properties have changed hands several times and not been reassessed for taxes in decades. So the tax revenue is needed. However, there is concern in the con column that the increase in taxes to the property owner will be passed along to the shop owner if they're renting retail space or commercial space, and that could then get passed along to the consumer. There is nothing that prohibits that.
There is one other question too, and maybe you can answer this, Rachel. How much more resources would Prop 15 give schools than what they currently receive? Is there an estimate in any of the nonpartisan information?
Because we're not sure exactly how much it would raise, somewhere between 6.5 and 11.5 billion is a pretty wide margin or range. So there isn't hard data on how much money in dollars, but I can tell you that of the 60% that would go to school, or excuse me, the four, yes, 60% that would go to schools. Please let me make sure that I have that right. Excuse me. Yes, counties would receive 60% of the revenue. 40% of the revenue would go to schools and community colleges. Schools would receive 89% of that money, and community colleges would get 11%. And that is the closest I can come to hard numbers on that, because we don't know what the tax revenue ultimately will be.
And one last question, how does this affect small-time residential property owners?
It doesn't affect residential property owners at all. In fact, this is an effort to bifurcate or split property tax assessments. Prop 13 passed in 1978 kind of lumps all property in together. And right now, Prop 15 would like to separate residential from commercial specifically so they can be assessed separately and differently. We're gonna get to a Prop 19 that covers residential changes, but this Prop 15 is something brand new. This means that it would be a new way, a completely new way, and a new schedule for assessing commercial property.
Wonderful. And one last question, because I've seen a few of them. There's some questions about how this impacts small businesses and or tax breaks for those small businesses. Can you talk a little bit about how this would impact them?
Sure. Small businesses with fewer than 50 employees would not be subjected to this. And if there is a personal, there is a $500,000 tax break that they can claim if they make improvements to their property, which is expected to happen. So kind of the upside of this is it could encourage some commercial and industrial property owners to upgrade their properties, because then they will get $500,000 tax break from that. But small businesses and small franchises, things like, you know, Starbucks and that kind of stuff, those individually owned franchises, they would not be subjected to this. This is really for $3 million properties and above.
Great, and I attempted to act like that was the last one, but I feel like since I was a little bit slow on getting started that maybe it should handle a couple more. There are questions about how this affects senior citizens and whether it affects renters.
It doesn't. That is Prop 19. And those are excellent questions because Prop 19 does affect senior citizens and renters. And there's another Prop 21 on rent control. So all of that's going to get covered, but those are great questions.
Great. And then if Proposition 15 passes, when will it go into effect?
2023.
Is that full effect, Rachel? Is there a rolling one? They're going to do, I'm going to ask, but somewhat paid attention. Is it fully implemented in 2023 and it starts ahead of time, or does it start in 2023 and then rolls out?
I think they're anticipating needing that time to set up a completely new tax assessment division.
Got it.
Because commercial property is now going to be, or presumably would be, if this passes, separate from residential.
Great. Colleen, do you see anything else you want to pull out of here before we move on to the next one?
No, I think we're ready to go on.
Great. Thank you. And if we have time at the end, we can come back to some of these. We're just trying to get through some of these more meeting ones and keep us compressed to a 6:15 schedule of ending to be respectful of all of your time. Please, Rachel.
Okay, so Prop 16, this is one that would allow diversity as a factor in public employment, education, and contracting decisions. The way it is now, again, this goes back to 1978, there was a United States Supreme Court decision that upheld affirmative action, which was an executive order signed by Kennedy back in 61, and other executive orders were signed after that. So it got tested in 78 in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld affirmative action. In 1996, the state of California voted to essentially shut that down. So since then, entities have been left to their own devices to create their own diversity plans and hiring practices. It is worth mentioning that when this passed in 1996, it was championed by Pete Wilson, who was the governor and who was trying to be the Democratic presidential nominee. And he used this as a wedge issue for voting. Okay, so what would Prop 16 do? It would repeal Prop 209, which was passed in 96, ending affirmative action in California, which is called Bakke. That case was Bakke. It would not create racial quotas in university admissions, but it would address disparities that I'm sure you're very aware of, which is Black and Latino students make up 60% of California's high school enrollment, but only 28% of UC admissions. So obviously the new policies would also have to be consistent with the 14th Amendment and other federal guidelines in place to protect people against discrimination either way. The economic impact, there doesn't seem to be one. Arguments for would mean equal opportunities for all Californians. Despite living in the most diverse state in the nation, women and people of color currently are still discriminated against. And we're at a historic moment and need to strengthen California by overturning discrimination in all areas. Arguments against. Approval of Prop 16 would be a step backwards, introducing a new form of discrimination that could play favorites for politicians or allow politicians to play favorites. Let's not perpetuate the stereotype that minorities and women can't make it unless they get special preferences. And it would require costly bureaucracies to enforce its provisions, burdening taxpayers. So the total money in support of this is $13.5 million. The California Democratic Party is backing this, California Federation of Teachers. And then the money against is $1 million. So we have $13 million for and $1 million against. And these are the people who are opposing this proposition. So The ultimate question is, should California and local government entities essentially repeal Prop 209 from 1996 and be allowed to consider diversity as a factor in public employment, education, and contracting decisions? And now I'll be very happy to answer some questions.
Thank you. Let's see what we have here. Ooh, I was trying to answer one. Somebody asked, wasn't Pete Wilson Republican? They thought you said Democrat.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, thank you. You are absolutely correct.
And is there anything in there about how Proposition 16 will be enforced? And their question being more is, will it be the Department of Justice or a newly created agency? Is there any discussion about that in this proposition?
I haven't come across that in my research. That's a great question. I imagine that it would be the Department of Justice the same way that it would be for any current case. If you were bringing a federal case or a discrimination case, even in the state or county, you would go through the courts.
Great, let's see. Anything else? If this passes, how soon will it go into effect?
I don't know that. That is an excellent question. I can see if there's something in the voter information guide. My understanding is that anything that requires new bodies to oversee the proposition's implementation take a long time because they need to train and build and whatnot. Since this has small fiscal impact, I'm going to guess that that means that it's very easy to implement and would probably go into effect in 2022.
Great. Colleen, do you see any other questions? There's a lot to scroll through, I think.
No, I think.
Okay, let's roll. So Prop 18 permits 17-year-olds who are going to be 18 by the next general election to vote in primaries and special elections. So the way this is now is that you guys can't vote until you're 18. You can register at 16 and be automatically, or early register at 16 and automatically be registered at 18, but you can't vote until you're 18. So what this would do is it would allow 17-year-olds to vote in primaries and special elections. It would also say that any registered voter could run for office, meaning a 17-year-old could run for office if they're going to be 18 by the election. And this is a mandatory proposition placed by the state legislature and the governor to amend the Constitution. The economic impact is hundreds of thousands of dollars, which in the grand scheme of the state budget is virtually nothing, less than 1%. Arguments for, in the March 2020 primary, with most votes in a California presidential primary ever, we still only had 38% voter turnout. So we have a civic engagement problem and we need to establish a culture of voting. These are the arguments for this. 17-year-olds pay taxes and they can join the military, so they should be able to participate in a full election cycle. And this proposition would encourage people to become familiar with voting, start early, and stay involved. Arguments against are that 17-year-olds don't pay taxes, or excuse me, they don't pay property taxes and whatnot, and they would be voting on measures like Prop 15 and Prop 19, which relate specifically to property taxes. So I'm going to read you the arguments against, and please forgive me, students in the audience, these are not my words. 17-year-olds are not biologically fully developed and are vulnerable to one-sided influence, and they have no real-world experience. So those are the official cons against this. Supporters have raised about $450,000, which is not a great deal of money for a measure, but it doesn't matter because the opponents raised $0. So they were hugely outraised by $450,000. This is opposed by the Republican Party, and it is supported by the Democratic Party. So the question is, should 17-year-olds who will be 18 by the general election be allowed to participate in a full election cycle? And now I'll take some questions.
Okay, so Rachel, do you know what other states, what the voting age is for in other states? Would we be the first one with 17-year-olds, or do other states have that?
There are 18 other states that allow this. So we wouldn't be the first, but we also wouldn't be in the majority.
Next, this is a good question. So this seems like a constant question. If this passes, how soon will it go into effect?
This is such a good question, and I want to thank all of you for keeping me on my toes, because that is not an answer I have at my fingertips. How soon would it go into effect? Again, the cost of implementation is so negligible. I would think that this would go into effect in 2022 or sooner, but I cannot say that with certainty, but that would be my educated guess. All they need to do essentially is print up more voter registration cards and reach out to more people. And that's only going to cost a couple $100,000.
So. Right. Right here in the state of California is that you actually can pre-register to vote as a 16 or 17 year old. So you can do that now at the Secretary of State's website. So in the event this gets passed, you're already well on your way to becoming a registered voter.
Great.
Throwing it out. Let's see. Rachel, do you have any examples of the other 18 states or 17 states that allow 17-year-olds to vote?
I don't. I don't have a list of who they are.
Okay. And just a clarification, somebody says my son will be 17 in 4 years, so he wouldn't get to vote in the next presidential election unless this passes. Is this correct?
It depends on when he turns 18. You won't be able to vote in the general election until you're 18 anyway. This only says that you can vote if you're 17 in primaries and in special elections, like if the governor stepped down and we needed to vote on a replacement or something along those lines, then the 17-year-old would be able to vote in something like that, but you couldn't vote for the president unless you were 18 in November, before November 3rd. Did I misunderstand the question?
No, you got it. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, Rachel, you wanna roll on to the next?
All right, here we go. So the rest of them I'm going to go through without Q&A. Out of respect for your time. And if you have additional questions, I suppose we can address them in some way toward the end. 19, this is another property tax one, but this one relates to residential. So this is home protection for seniors, severely disabled families, and victims of Wildfire or Natural Disasters Act. The way it is now, I'm going to let you read the slide and I'll explain it to you. The way it is now is that, going back to that Prop 13 in 1978, if you are over the age of 55, or you're severely disabled, or your house burns down or is ruined in an earthquake or any other horrible event, you can transfer your current tax assessment from your home to another home of equal or lesser value in the same county. And you can do that one time. That's the way it stands right now. What this proposition is proposing is that owners over the age of 55 or the severely disabled or people who've been displaced by a natural disaster would be able to transfer their property tax assessments up to three times, and they would be able to transfer them anywhere in the state of California. If you inherit a home and you don't live in it as your primary residence, they're going to come in and reassess it at current market value, which is not something that happens right now. And this is how we're losing out on a lot of tax money that's meant to flow into education and community services, is there are some gaps in the tax laws that are hoping to be addressed this year. So money raised through the new tax schedule and market rate assessments would create the California Fire Response Fund and the County Revenue Protection Fund. These would be entirely new governing bodies that would oversee fire response and revenue protection. So the economic impact is that it would, economic impact. The main thing that the revenue would be used for would be to create the fire response fund. 75% of the money raised would go to that, and 15% would go to the county, all to be dispersed from the state's general fund. They're anticipating it to grow to $100 million per year. So we're talking about real money. Arguments for it is that it closes these tax loopholes on inherited properties that aren't used as primary residences. A lot of those have turned into rentals or Airbnbs, and I know LA has addressed that through some other measures. Schools, local governments, and fire suppression efforts would benefit from the revenue, and it expands rules for eligible homeowners, allowing them to transfer their home's property tax anywhere in California 3 times. Arguments against are that it replaces some Prop 13 protections which were voted on by the people and passed. Children who inherit property valued at more than $1 million could be forced to sell the property to pay the tax increase. And this windfall for homeowners is not necessary because people who own homes in California already have money, ultimately, is what the arguments against are saying. So the people who support this are shown here. This is, the incorrect amount of money. The correct amount of money for Prop 19 is, in the many, many millions of dollars. I will know it, when I get to the next slide, because these guys have been outraised. So $45,000 has been raised versus $40 million. So $40 million have been raised to support this measure, and only $45,000 have been raised to oppose it. This didn't even meet the reporting threshold for that FPPC website I told you about. And so ultimately the question is, should the tax assessed values be changed and modify the rules to use new tax revenues for fire suppression, schools, and local government? It is worth remembering that this proposition does not change the tax rates, which were set in 1978 under Prop 13. This doesn't change the tax rate, it just alters the frequency and conditions under which residential properties are assessed. Okay, Prop 21, this expands government's authority to enact rent control on residential property. The way it is now is that, again, it goes back to a state Supreme Court case in 1976 when they supported the right of the city of Berkeley to enact rent control. And then in 1995, the Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act was passed, and that put some parameters around rent control. And then in 2018, the public voted to repeal Costa-Hawkins, but that effort failed. So Costa-Hawkins is the law of the land, and it puts some parameters around the 1976 Supreme Court decision. So what this proposition would do is basically allow local governments to establish rent control on residential properties that have been occupied and are over 15 years old. We don't currently allow that. It would also allow landlords who own no more than 2 homes to exempt themselves from these policies. And the economic impact, it's tough to say because rent control is a local issue. And so local communities would be left to decide how they want to implement this. And so the costs are really going to vary. Some of the economic impact to the community is that landlords might sell rental properties rather than receive less money on them from rent. They might also choose to sell the rental property to the people who are renting it. The value of rental housing could decline because it will be less profitable to be a landlord, and it could result in less construction of new rental housing, again, because if rentals aren't as profitable, people will be less likely to build them. So the arguments for this are that just pass this and let the communities decide what is going to be best for them. They know better than the state does. That this proposition does guarantee landlords a reasonable profit. And perhaps most important to people, this can help against gentrification. So if you're in a neighborhood where, you know, you've grown up your whole life and you want to stay in that neighborhood, but you don't want to stay in your mom and dad's house and you can't afford to rent there now because miraculously it's just turned into like some crazy place to try to rent, this would help with that. Arguments against are that seniors and veterans could be displaced due to landlords selling their properties. It could result in less available and less affordable housing, and it would stop new housing from being built, or could. So supporters have raised $24 million to support this, and the opponents have outraised the supporters roughly 2-1. So the people who are opposed to this are really opposed to this. And that includes the Veterans Association. So the question is, should California allow cities and counties to impose more rent control than allowed now, including on newer buildings, single family homes, and vacant units? It's worth mentioning that what rent control would do also is that when someone vacates a property, in between tenants, the landlords can't jack the rent. So Proposition 24 amends consumer privacy laws. This one is crazy. It is 52 pages long. You're very welcome to go read it for yourselves if you are having trouble sleeping. Essentially what happened is there was a property developer in San Francisco named Alistair McTaggart, and he wanted to enact some privacy laws. So he got together with an analyst from the CIA, and they wrote all of this wording, and they wanted to present it, and the state legislature got out in front of them and passed their own thing called CPPA. The problems that McTaggart now has with CPPA is he said that the state legislature didn't include the word share. It says that you can't sell a consumer's private data, but it doesn't say you can't sell or share. And if anyone has ever advertised on Google or Facebook, you know that you share your customers' data with Google and Facebook, you don't sell it to them. So it hasn't really, by McTaggart's estimation, it hasn't had the teeth that he originally imagined. But the CIA analyst that he worked on with it disagrees with him. And so now these two people are in a fight over trying to change what the state legislature passed in 2018. They're on different sides. So what this proposition would do, really just boiling it down to brass tacks. So here is, it would add that word share so that you can't sell or share customer data. And it would make it a little more onerous to opt out. Right now you can opt out through two entities. This would make it so that you have to opt out from 300 different companies. And probably one of the biggest concerns is that it could create different levels of service. Meaning if you're a cost conscious consumer, you may choose to sell your data and buy the service for less money. And what this means is that we could essentially end up in a situation where people pay for privacy, where wealthier consumers pay a little more money not to have to sell their data, and cost conscious consumers opt for the less expensive package and find their data is public. The economic impact is $20 million for the CPPA from the state's general fund, and increased DOJ costs because they've increased the fine, which is $7,500. So honestly, Google and Facebook, they don't care. $7,500 is nothing to them. What this could do, though, is hurt small startups. If they get busted for this, then they have to pay $7,500. And again, you've got this situation where the wealthier companies aren't scathed and the smaller companies are, and the wealthier consumers aren't scathed and the cost-conscious consumers are. Right now, California is the only state that has privacy laws regarding data. And it's been really hard to police it. So arguments for are that it would prevent businesses from using or sharing your sensitive data. It would add teeth to the current CPPA wording, and that we need new laws like this to keep a pace with technology. Arguments against, that it leaves the tech giants unscathed and can hurt smaller startups. 2 years is not enough time to see if CPPA is working. They only passed it in 2018, and it puts the burden on consumers to opt out of countless data collection practices one by one that are currently barred by default. So, not surprising, Alistair McTaggart has donated $5.5 million to get this through. The people opposing it have raised $48,000. So, this is one of the ones where the money doesn't really tell the whole story, because Alistair McTaggart is a wealthy property developer from Northern California. Ultimately, it comes down to, do you want to find yourself in a situation where you have to decide between a higher price and lower protection, or do you want the same level of protection for everybody, which is what we currently have? Okay, Prop 24. So this is the CPPA one. So should we add teeth to a two-year-old measure or should we just leave it as is and see if we circle back on this one? Prop 25 is a referendum on law that replaces money bail with a system based on public safety and flight risk. This is one of several criminal justice reform measures on the ballot this year. The way it is now is that, you know, if you get arrested, you have to post bail. If you can't afford it, you have to go to a bail bond company and end up owing them, even if the charges are dropped or you're found not guilty. So it aims to address the inequities in our current bail process, which allows wealthier people to bail out and allows for punitive fees or prolonged detention for those who can't post bail from their own resources. Ultimately, Prop 25 is Senate Bill 10. Okay, Senate Bill 10 was passed in 2018, and then the bail bond companies said, no, we don't like this. And so they got enough signatures together to hit the pause button on SB 10. Voting yes on Prop 25 just says, let SB 10 go into action. In the meantime, while SB 10 was on pause, people had expressed concerns about algorithms, judges doing risk assessment, that maybe it could not be great for people of color. There were some worries about the way that it was going to be implemented. So in the interim, since SB 10 was put on pause, the legislature passed SB 36. And that specifically addresses the concerns about SB 10. So if you vote yes on Prop 25, it just activates SB 10, and then there's SB 36 that's already there to protect against some of the concerns about implementation. The economic impact, it would impact both state and local governments, but the costs are uncertain because it will depend on how the measure is interpreted and implemented. Arguments for are that the current system favors rich defendants who can easily make bail. People are eventually found not guilty or not even charged, and then they're stuck with a large debt to the bail bond company. Arguments against are that it has good intentions, but it could result in more people being jailed. That's one of those points that's been countered by SB 36, and that it will cost taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Okay, so the supporters have raised about $12 million, Western Center on Law and Poverty, et cetera. And the money against is about half of what the supporters have raised. So the question is, should we affirm SB 10 that was passed in 2018 and replace money bail with a system based on public safety and flight risk? It is worth noting that when they say that they're releasing people because they're not a risk, sometimes that will involve ankle bracelets and other monitoring devices. So it's not a matter of just opening the doors and turning people out. There will be other methods employed to keep track of people between their arrest and their trial. Prop 17, this is another criminal justice reform one. This restores a right to vote after the completion of a prison term. The way it is now is that if you're on parole, you can't vote because that's continued an extension of your prison sentence. And there are about 50,000 people on parole in California. What this would do is it would restore voting rights to those people. This is a mandatory prop placed by the state legislature and the governor. It would amend the state constitution to allow people with felonies who are on parole to vote. The economic impact, it would increase the number of eligible workers. Cost of printing, it's negligible. It's less than 1% of the state budget. Arguments for are that people should be returned to society. They've paid their debt to society and they should be returned to society and allowed to participate. They're paying taxes. They're out. The people against, the arguments against are that it puts the public at risk by letting people out of jail, but the judges will do risk assessment and they have all sorts of ways in SB 36, they have all sorts of, or not SB 36. Yes, in SB 36 also for this one, all sorts of different ways of implementing this. So the total money for allowing parolees to vote is $1.18 million and the opposition has raised zero. So the question is, should people on parole in California be allowed to vote? Prop 20 restricts parole for certain offenses currently considered to be nonviolent. So the way it happened is in 2016, 2014, and 2011, there were some props passed that redefined some nonviolent and non-serious felonies to misdemeanors. They did that because the state Supreme Court mandated that we had to be operating our prisons at below 137% capacity. So what this prop would do, among others, is it would expand the list of crimes that do not allow early parole. It would recategorize particular misdemeanor crimes to ones that are chargeable as either misdemeanors or felonies, and it would require the collection of DNA samples from anybody convicted of particular misdemeanors. Because what happened in 2014 was by reclassifying some crimes to reduce the prison population, they stopped collecting DNA because the crimes were no longer considered felonies. And right now we only collect DNA from people who are charged with felonies. So we're missing out on some DNA, which is really helpful in solving future crimes and past crimes. Economic impact is tens of millions of dollars and a belief that it would increase the prison population. Arguments for, by reclassifying certain crimes as violent, it would ensure that those convicted would serve their full sentences. And it also corrects some unforeseen side effects like the DNA gathering of previous propositions. And I hope you're reading quickly. and are done with this slide. Okay, the arguments against are that it could potentially impact vulnerable minorities disproportionately, that it slashes mental health and rehabilitation programs that help to prepare people for release from prison, and it would result in extreme sentences. The supporters have raised very little money in relation to the opponents. And this is supported by a prominent Republican, among others, and the California Republican Party. And the opponents are the ACLU, California Teachers Association, et cetera, and they have raised $5.6 million to fight this. So the question is, should California law be amended to make changes to the process by which people are charged with certain crimes and the process for granting them parole? This is a very controversial one, and I must remain nonpartisan. So those are the pros and the cons. County Measure J, budget allocation for alternatives to incarceration. What this will do is it amends the charter. Basically, this came about in the last few months as the country has addressed civil unrest and civil injustice. It shifts money from punishment to treatment. What it ultimately says is that no less than 10% of the state budget can be spent on community services and alternatives to incarceration. Basically, take money from policing and prisons and put it toward community programs and education. So the way it is now is the LA County Board of Supervisors decides how to spend the money. This is similar to a measure that was passed in March that authorized the commission to develop a plan to reduce jail population and incarceration. The economic impact, not entirely sure, because no one's really put forward a plan yet saying exactly where they would spend the money. I think communities are still discussing where they want to spend that money, where they think it's smartest and best. But the LA County has a huge general fund, and you can see this little line down here is education. And this third line here is public protection. So again, this would require that no less than 10% of this big fund be spent on community programs. So proponents say that it's necessary to address the disproportionate impact of racial injustice by prioritizing health, housing, youth development, and jobs in low-income and underserved communities. Arguments against are that it prevents the county supervisory boards from acting nimbly to meet community needs in real time, et cetera. And I will tell you that the League of Women Voters could not find verifiable financial data for Measure J, but we can see who is supporting this. And these are the people who are behind it, the ACLU, Patrice Cullors, one of the co-founders of BLM. And it was drafted to call for civil justice and reform in our communities. And again, I just don't have verifiable financial data. Prop 22, it exempts, this is the one for Lyft and Uber. Okay, so what happened was AB 5 got passed and the state said, Lyft and Uber and DoorDash and Yummy and all you guys who use drivers, you have to make these people employees. You have to make them employees and you have to give them health benefits and time off and sick leave and all of that kind of stuff. And Lyft and Uber said, if you're gonna do that, we're gonna leave the state. So that's pretty much the way it is now. The drivers work as independent contractors. AB 5 is being fought through this proposition. And what this proposition would do is it would reclassify them as independent contractors again, but with a few perks. There would be increases if you work a number of hours and medical expenses if you're injured while driving. And so it's kind of a compromise between making them full employees and taking on the onerous task of paying health benefits for even part-time drivers, but it does say, we understand that we should be doing more than we're currently doing. This is a really important thing for our communities right now. Because of COVID, so many of us are using delivery services for groceries and food and everything else. And so their threat to leave the state, I don't know how serious that is, but they believe in it enough to have put together this compromise. And they is they being Lyft and Uber and DoorDash. So the arguments for is that classifying drivers as employees would lead to longer wait times and higher prices. It would improve delivery and rideshare work, and it creates a middle ground. It's a compromise. Arguments against is that it would eliminate basic workplace protections, and we should demand a broader answer from San Francisco than AB 5. So the money behind this, no surprise, Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash have raised $185 million. They're the biggest donors. And the people against it, including the California Teachers Association, have raised $13.7 million. This is a really big topic. It's worth reading more on this because this is California, this is Los Angeles, there are gig workers here. And so it's really an important measure for people who supplement their income as actors, actresses, writers, whatnot, by driving Lyft and Uber. So the question is, should app-based rideshare and delivery drivers be classified as independent contractors? So we are getting to the last couple ones here. So this is authorizes bonds to continue funding stem cell and other research. The way it is now is that in 2004, the federal government stopped funding stem cell research and the states had to pick it up. And so they sold $3 billion in bonds to raise money for research grants and administration of those grants and oversight. That money is almost gone. So what this prop would do is sell another $5.5 billion this time in bonds. And it would also set up a committee to oversee the CIRM, which is the governing body for stem cell research, to make sure that any advancements or inventions that occur during the process of research that's been funded by the state would belong to the state, or partly belong to the state. The economic impact is that it would raise a lot of money for the state. It would give about $260 million to the general fund per year. And the general fund for this coming year is $222.2 billion. So the arguments for are that so far it's led to great research and discoveries. It changes the CIRM's ability to be accountable to us, efficient, and funding has generated $10.7 billion in economic stimulus so far. So the $3 billion sale of bonds, the previous one, worked out pretty well for the state, and they just want to do it again. The cons are that the federal government has started funding stem cell research again, and so maybe the state doesn't need to do this. However, it is in the Republican national platform to defund stem cell research. So we're kind of caught between not knowing if that's going to stop or whether the state would need to pick it up again. Supporters have raised about $6.5 million and opponents have raised $250. So not a lot of people against this. The question is, should we sell $5.5 billion in bonds to continue funding stem cell research? And the other medical one that's on the ballot this year is kidney dialysis. This is a little complicated. Okay, the way it is now is that there are about 600 dialysis clinics in California. 72% of them are owned by two companies, DaVita and Fresenius. So there's a $3 billion industry for kidney dialysis, and 72% of those $3 billion are split between two companies. The way it is right now is that you don't have to have a physician. You have to have a medical director for a clinic, but you don't have to have a physician on site. And you don't have to report infection rates to the CDC or the state health department. What this prop would do is take care of both of those things. It would say you must have a licensed physician on site anytime there's a treatment happening. You have to report infections. And also you can't discriminate against people based on the way they pay, which would be Medicare, Medi-Cal, or private insurance. The economic impact. Well, if dialysis center owner operators close down clinics, which is what they're threatening to do due to the cost of hiring a full-time physician, the patients who use them will have to find dialysis elsewhere. And that's life-threatening if they miss treatments. The cost to clinics for additional reporting component is not significant, but the cost for having a full-time physician is, and the state has a current physician shortage. So the arguments for are that the patient should have access to a doctor when they're there getting treated, that they should, these clinics should be reporting infection rates to the state and the CDC, and that strong protections against payment prejudice should be extended to the patients. Arguments against are that it's going to force clinics to close because the costs will be prohibitive. It's going to worsen the physician shortage, and that dialysis clinics are already strictly regulated by the state. So the supporters, and again, I do apologize, I have the wrong slide here, so please bear with me. The supporters ultimately are DaVita and Fresenius. They're the ones who have raised the most money to, or excuse me, no, they're the ones fighting it. So the supporters, I do have the right slide. It's been a long day. Thank you for staying with me. Total money raised to support this is $6.2 million. $93 million have been raised basically by DaVita and Fresenius to fight this. So Prop 23 in a nutshell says, should we be able to monitor clinics' prejudice against payment methods? Should they have a physician on site at all times? And should they be reporting their infection rates? And that's it. I'm going to pass it over to Amanda, who will go through Measure RR. And thank you very, very much for your time. It has truly been an honor and a pleasure to address you tonight. And I hope you found this useful and interesting. Please vote. Go to vote411.org if you have any questions, or votersedge.org is a great one also. That's a resource that has all this information here. And as you go through it, it will let you save your choices and you can print that out for reference while you fill out your ballot. So thank you very much and please vote.
Rachel, thank you so very much. Some of you have asked whether this recording will be posted. We do plan to post it on the district's website, achieve.lusd.net/vote2020. I imagine it'll be up in the next couple of days. I'm gonna, since we told everybody we're gonna try and keep this to 6:15, I do have a presentation, but I'm gonna go through it quickly and skip through some slides, just in the interest of everybody's time. I can share really quick. Okay, so in addition to the state measures and the Measure J that Rachel spoke about, for those of you who live within LA Unified boundaries, there's also Measure RR on the ballot. It is a school upgrades and safety measure. The measure is a $7 billion bond, again, on the November ballot. The Board of Education voted unanimously to place it on the ballot to address significant and unfunded needs of Los Angeles public school facilities that are currently estimated at $50 billion. It requires 55% of the votes cast to pass. Measure RR is a bond. There is a cost to that. It is estimated to be approximately 2.2 cents per $100 of assessed valuation, generating $329 million annually until approximately 2055. This measure is projected to extend the repayment for all LAUSD bonds by 4 years. So currently property owners are paying for LAUSD bonds. This would add to that. It is structured in a way that the rate that people are paying at the time of the election will not go up with this measure, but it would extend that period of repayment. And as old bonds are sold off, that repayment amount would go down. As mentioned, I'm going to go through this, $50 billion of unfunded needs. The majority of students are learning in old and outdated classrooms, and facilities inequities exist throughout the district. I saw earlier there are a number of students who are attending San Pedro High School who are on this call. Some of you are getting a project called a comprehensive modernization that is looking to address those inequities to bring your school up to a higher standard, closer to a new school. So this bond would help with some of that work. More than 70% of our school buildings are 50 years old or older. I'm gonna jump through this. This is what the ballot question looks like. Again, $7 billion, about 2.2 cents per $100 of assessed property value. It would update classrooms and labs and technology, reduce asbestos, earthquake and water quality hazards, replace and renovate aging school classrooms and buildings. Again, in interest of time, this is board priorities for how those funds would be spent. The first one is about those large comprehensive modernization projects and doing more of those. The second category is about replacing roofs and broken systems, plumbing, asphalt, et cetera. Third, we have a number of different buildings and sites that are not ADA compliant. We have a lot of work to do to be able to reach compliance. So there will be money set aside to continue to do that work. Funds invested in additional wellness clinics, perhaps some investments in athletic and recreational opportunities, athletic fields, et cetera. As previous bonds have included, there are funds that would be dedicated for improvements to early education centers, improvements to adult education centers. There is funding in here for charter schools as well. This is all facilities related for capital improvements. So it's all the buildings and systems, some type of technology. We will continue to improve school cafeterias. There are sites that don't have sufficient cafeterias or do not have air conditioning. This bond would look to do some of that work. And then there are two different categories, first and the second on this page for technology, devices, network infrastructure upgrades, wanting to strengthen the Wi-Fi at school campuses. Some of our buses are old and inefficient. We'd continue to our work to build to to purchase new buses. And there is funding set aside to continue oversight. We have an Office of Inspector General who does audits and he would continue that work. There is a bond oversight committee. We are required to have one by law. We've had an oversight committee in place since 1997, and that oversight committee would continue with this new bond. Every single bond dollar has to be reviewed by the oversight committee in a public meeting, and then it goes to the board in a public meeting before we're able to spend it on any project. As a summary, the money is about updating or it's about upgrading and modernizing our schools, not about building new schools. It will cost about 2.2 cents per $100 assessed valuation. It's going to extend the period of time that people would be paying for bonds. If this bond does not pass, that means that people will be done paying off LAUSD bonds sooner. And we anticipate to put about $1 billion of work in. Now, my presentation is different than Rachel's, so I quickly pulled out the supporters and opposers real quick. Let's say those who oppose Measure RR say that the district has money it hasn't spent. There's a cost to it. Enrollment is declining. It does nothing to improve education and it isn't needed. Those folks, it was the argument against was signed by Larry Sand, a retired LAUSD teacher, Michael Antonovich, a retired LA County supervisor, and John Kupel, I think I said that wrong, with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association for the argument, or for those who support, they say it's needed, that there is a lot of work to be done, that there are inequities, that our kids need updated school learning technology, modernized and updated facilities, and that we need to make upgrades for COVID-19 cleanliness and distancing requirements. And the folks who have supported this, sorry, I print out too many pages, include Xavier Skosky, former LA County Supervisor, Wendy Gruhl, former Los Angeles City Controller, Tracy Hernandez, founding CEO of Los Angeles County Business Federation, Michael Lawson, President and CEO of Los Angeles Urban League, Charmaine Morales, registered nurse, executive vice president, United Nurses Associations of California. Oh, and more. They had more. Cherise Brimman Weaver with the Brotherhood Crusade. Elma Roldan with the Community and Schools of Los Angeles. Jessica Perry Martin, a county teacher of the year at Cesar Chavez Learning Academies in San Fernando. Ron Miller, executive secretary with the Los Angeles Orange County Construction and Building Trades. And Mary Leslie, president of Los Angeles Business Council. So I think I hit on those with regards to Measure RR. It will not be in the state official voter guide. You'll have to look for your county sample ballot from the Los Angeles County Register of Voters. Again, it is a bond measure on the ballot for those of you residing within LA Unified boundaries, and it would be a tax on all property owners. With that, if you've got, we still have 420 people here. I can, Rachel, if you have a few minutes, we can take a few more questions if you'd like. Are you open to that, Rachel?
Absolutely.
All right, so I'm gonna turn off my video. You guys, if you wanna put some questions in the Q&A, we're happy to spend another 5, maybe 10 minutes. Let's say no later than 6:30. We'll do 9 minutes and do a clean 6:30 stop. All right. Let's see. Colleen, do you want to pull some up?
Yeah, I had one from the Prop 21. How is Prop 21 different from the most recent rent control proposition that voters decided?
The most recent, the one Prop 10 that was on the ballot in 2018, that would have repealed Costa Hawkins. And this is looking to amend it. I could tell you specifically, Prop 10 would have repealed Costa Hawkins on the content of local rent control ordinances. It would not have imposed rent control on any jurisdiction, but it would have allowed cities and counties to go through their own legislative processes to create rent control ordinances. It was defeated 59-41 in 2018. Prop 21, conversely, has different wording in there about properties that are more than 15 years old and increasing rental rates, limit increasing of rental rates after a unit is vacated. So in the short answer is that in 2018, they voted to repeal it. And what this one is doing is just amend it.
Okay, great. And along those same lines, somebody asked, if you purchase a rental home with tenants, would you not be able to increase the rent for that same proposition?
If you change, if it changes hands of ownership, that is a very good question. I will tell you that if you already own two or more rental properties, your property taxes are probably going to go up if Prop 19 passes, or Prop 15 rather. Can you raise the rent if you take new ownership of an occupied building? That is an excellent question. And I confess that I don't have an answer to that, but I encourage you to go to Voters Edge and other resources and find an answer for it, which is exactly what I will be doing after this meeting.
I see somebody asked, can we drop off our ballots at any official Dropbox?
Ah, thank you for bringing that up. Again, I'm going to go back to voter or vote411.org, which will point you toward links to find the official ballot Dropboxes nearest you. Yes, you may drop them in any Dropbox. It doesn't need to be the one closest to you. They put that information up for your own convenience. But you can put it in an official Dropbox. They will have an LA County stamp on it and the seal of California on it. And it says very clearly on a yellow box, official Dropbox. If anybody tells you you need a stamp to put it in there, they're wrong. If anybody tells you you can't use that box, they're wrong. You can obviously also mail your ballot and you can vote in person. But please find official drop boxes only.
Rachel, I'm going to answer one. I see one that said, what happened to all facilities money already? LAUSD keeps asking for money to fix schools, but schools are still broken. It is true. LAUSD, since 1997, voters have approved 5 LAUSD bonds. And those funds have gone to build new schools because there was overcrowding, though there may not be now, there had been. And they've gone to fix some old schools as well. But the school district has just about 700 school sites. And they have not been able to address all that work. Even buildings that were fixed before, or you had an HVAC system that was fixed 20 years ago and needs to be replaced in another 20 years. So it is true, voters have approved, it's actually $20.605 billion since 1997. 131 new schools have been built. We've made investments in existing campuses, but there's still a lot of work to be done. As I pointed out, there's $50 billion worth of need.
We have 3 minutes left for more questions.
So for Prop 23, yes vote means many facilities would close due to lack of physician on site. Is that correct?
That's what the two main providers, Fresenius and DaVita, that's what they're threatening. I don't know how true that is. It's a $3 billion industry. I don't know if they are willing to back out of that. I will tell you that the state health department has some say in whether clinics can close. So I'm not sure how toothy that threat is. They're making a lot of money in an industry where they have a virtual monopoly. I mean, two of them have 72% of the business. So it doesn't mean, if you vote yes on 23, it doesn't mean you're voting for the closure of clinics. It means that the two companies who've raised a lot of money to fight this are saying that they will close clinics.
And if Prop 25 doesn't pass, does it go back to current status, or would SB 10 work at some point?
If Prop 25 doesn't pass, SB 10 is dead.
Okay.
But this is part of a larger national conversation. This is in the Democratic platform nationally to address money bond.
And Amanda, for Measure RR, does it take away from learning funding?
It does not. Measure RR would be new money and a new tax, essentially. And those dollars can only be used for capital purposes. So it cannot be used for teacher salaries or administrative purposes. So it does not take away from any of the money that currently exists. It creates new money that can only be used for capital purposes.
And what does a yes vote on Measure J mean?
A yes vote on Measure J. Let me pull up my slides. Excuse me for one moment. A yes vote on Measure J means that you're agreeing that 10% of the overall state budget has to be allocated for community development. So the money would be taken from the state budget and dispersed to local communities, and the local communities themselves would get to determine which programs they would like to foster or improve. But the primary objective is to provide, this is the defund the police measure. I'm just gonna come out and say it. This is what they mean by this, that they would take money from law enforcement essentially and give it to the communities to improve community services, mental health programs, addiction treatment centers, schools, after school programs, that sort of thing. So if you vote yes for it, you're saying that you want 10% of the general fund budget to go to your community, to all communities, to assist with finding alternatives to incarceration. Start young.
Okay, and that's all we have time for.
Thank you everybody for joining us. It was Rachel, for your time, for explaining this, for all of the good questions. As mentioned, we will be posting the recording on the district's website. We are confirming with the League of Women Voters as to whether we can also present the slide deck. Again, we urge everybody to vote however you vote. We don't care how you vote, just that you do vote. And we are, was it 20 days away from the election and 5 days away from the deadline to register to vote. So if you are not registered to vote yet, you still have 5 days to do that by mail or online. Go to lavote.net. Also, if you've changed your address, you can do that on that website as well. LAvote.net also has a ton of other resources with regards to vote centers, official drop boxes, et cetera. So thank you all. We appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your evening.